Good morning. Can you hear me okay? No. Okay. Oh, that's better. That's better. Slides are up. Great. This morning, I'd like to start with a reading from Genesis 1. It's the Message translation, so it's a bit more poetic even than the Bible and some of the other English translations. It's the first day of creation, and then I'm jumping to the sixth day of creation, because otherwise it's a very long reading. First this: God created the heavens and the earth. All you see, all you don't see. Earth was a soup of nothingness, a bottomless emptiness, an inky blackness. God's spirit brooded like a bird above the watery abyss. God spoke, light, and light appeared. God saw that light was good and separated light from dark. God named the light day. He named the dark night. It was evening. It was morning. Day one. God spoke, earth, generate life. Every sort and kind, cattle and reptiles and wild animals, all kinds. And there it was, wild animals of every kind, cattle of all kinds, every sort of reptile and bug. And God saw that it was good. God spoke, let us make human beings in our image, make them reflecting our nature, so that they can be responsible for the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, the cattle, and yes, for Earth itself, every animal that moves on the face of Earth. So God created human beings. He created them godlike, reflecting God's nature. He created them male and female, and God blessed them. Prosper, reproduce, fill Earth, take charge. Be responsible for the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, for every living thing that moves on the face of Earth. Then God said, I've given you every sort of seed-bearing plant on Earth, every kind of fruit-bearing tree, to all animals and birds, and I've given them to you for food, to all animals and all birds, everything that moves and breathes, I give whatever grows out of the ground for food. And there it was. God looked over everything that God had made, and it was so good. So very good. It was evening. It was morning. Day six. I'm talking about climate change today. It's something that I'm very passionate about. It's a topic that I've been journeying with for a long time. So today I'm going to share some reflections from my journey, how I started it and where I have landed, and some of the stops along the way. It's my journey. That means it's not necessarily yours. I grew up in a very particular context. Journey with me. I can only speak from what I know, so I'm going to start with some assumptions. I believe that our global climate is changing. I believe that this is at least partly due to our reliance on fossil fuels, the ways that these release carbon, our overconsumption, and it's changing the weather patterns in the world around us, all across the globe. I've chosen to take the UN and other scientific bodies seriously when they report about the crisis level that we are reaching when it comes to this. And it's my conviction that as industrialized nations in the developed world, we need to lead the way to change and find solutions. I agree with you, Helen, that it's probably these guys that are going to do it for us. These beliefs and convictions have shaped how I think about this issue. It's just very personal to me. When I was in uni, I had a bumper sticker on my laptop that said God's original plan was to hang out in a garden with two naked vegetarians. It's a little bit edgy for Christian college, but it said God on it, and it was Southern California, so it was okay. I went to uni in a pocket of Southern California that, while it was a Christian college, it was a little bit more progressive, a bit more environmentally conscious. We had an environmental club on campus. But that's not where I started my climate journey. I grew up in a very conservative household, politically conservative, socially conservative, conservative evangelical churches. I'm not saying that you can't be an American evangelical and be an environmentalist, but you gotta work really hard at it. There's politics that play into that. There is a deep-seated feeling that trees are a liberal issue. There's a historic connection to big oil. There's an inherent distrust of scientists because evolution. all of that makes it very difficult for my family to understand that I deeply love Jesus and have committed my life to following him, and I am deeply concerned about environmental issues. That's a tension that my family really struggles to understand. That's broad brush, and also my own experience. America's a very big country. There are a lot of American theologians who are doing good work when it comes to this issue. But when I was 16, I had not met any of them yet. So I was very happy for this to be an earthly thing that we didn't have to worry about. I can remember at one point it was suggested in a church setting that if predictions were true and we were headed toward this sort of global chaos, then that was actually a good thing and we should hurry it along because then maybe Jesus would come back faster. So that's the context that I grew up in. This is the moment of truth. It works. As I got older into my late teens, started taking science classes at school, learning about some of the things we sang about this morning, the outer details of the universe and its bigness and how it reflects God's glory and how it all fits together, and as well as teeny tiny microscopic pieces of cells, and it just blew my mind that all of this works in such an orchestrated and synchronized dance. That's a photo from the Hubble telescope, some of those outer universe details. And we sing some of those same songs that we sing this morning in my conservative evangelical churches, and it was the start of the rumblings of dissonance for me, that we could sing these and say that they proclaim God's glory and yet not care about what was happening to the earth around us. It was around this time that I loved the book of Job, not because of my teen angst, although I had plenty of that as well, but because of the poetry about nature that's in it. When you grow up in a place where it doesn't rain, poetry about rainstorms is very powerful. So that's where I started to feel dissonance around this issue. And then I started uni, and around that time, that is when the polar bears became a talking point. I was starting to learn more about the world around me, taking in global news. Photographers were coming down from the Arctic, bringing back photos of emaciated polar bears, and they were struggling to hunt on ice sheets because the ice was melting because of our carbon footprint. As a call to action, it worked for me. If my lifestyle was to blame, then that didn't feel like good stewardship, and I could sort of square that up with my faith. I also grew up with Coca-Cola adverts at Christmas time, which have cuddly cartoon polar bears, so it hit an emotional level for me. So in my fervor, which I have spoken about before, my 20-year-old fervor, I became a vegetarian. I bought a reusable water bottle and a t-shirt that said herbivore on it. I became a vehement recycler, much to the thrill of my housemates. I hosted Meatless Monday potlucks for the environmental club on my uni campus. And I dug deep into the prophets when Isaiah and Jeremiah talk about the destruction of land and woe to the people. I was there for it. If I'm honest, this was fueled by guilt. I didn't know how to deal with such a big topic, and so it became all about my actions and what I was doing. But it's all well and good about polar bears, and they call you to action for a minute, but they feel very far away if the only place you've ever seen them is a Coca-Cola advert or the Highland Wildlife Park. And so my resolve started to slip. I knew it was a problem. I wasn't sure how to tackle it. The guilt got bigger. But it was around this time that I started studying again, looking particularly into Old Testament agriculture, the modern food system. It turns out you can't spend a lot of time looking into agriculture and food without bumping back into these issues of environmental justice. But for the first time, I was faced with the immediacy and the human cost of this issue. Up till this time, it had been about trees and bears. But according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, one person is displaced every second by climate and weather disasters worldwide. That is an average of 26 million people every year. That number is going to continue to grow in coming years because it is rural communities that are hit hardest as they struggle to cope with warmer weather, more erratic rainfall, changing weather patterns. A recent report from the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights states that climate change will have devastating consequences for people living in poverty around the world. Even under our best-case scenarios, hundreds of millions will face food insecurity, forced migration, disease, and death. Climate change threatens the future of human rights and risks undoing the last 50 years of the progress that we've made in development, global health, and poverty reduction. And the World Bank predicts that between the years 2030 and 2050, climate-related disasters will cause an additional 250,000 deaths from malaria, malnutrition, illness, and heat stress. Because people living in poverty are often uninsured, these climate-related disasters will continue to make worse health shocks that already push 100 million people into poverty every year. The reality is that changing and unpredictable weather patterns make droughts last longer and push floodwaters higher, pushing people from homes and their livelihoods. In places where hurricanes and fires are already in a normal part of life, those seasons start earlier and end later. And erratic rainfall and unpredictable weather seasons make crops and livestock unpredictable, which has knock-on effects for the people who rely on those, both for their own food and for their livelihoods. These are not just future tense issues. It's happening now, and there's a human cost. Climate change is a matter of justice. It's the poorest and most vulnerable people in the world who are being hardest hit by climate-related changing weather patterns. Yet they are the least responsible for creating this climate crisis, and that is unjust. If we take Jesus at his word when he says that we are to care for the least of these, surely that includes those who are living in the front lines of a climate crisis. Now, there's a counter-argument to all of this, and it's one that I grew up in. It's one that I'm familiar with. Jesus is coming back. We've been promised a new earth. He's going to bring it with him, and he wouldn't let it get too bad before he intervened, so we can just continue with business as usual. This is the thinking I grew up with. It's drawn from a literal interpretation of the book of Revelation. Those interpretations differ. I have some questions about this point of view. We've done terrible things to each other and to the earth over the course of human history, and Jesus has yet to come back and intervene. If we're using that as our barometer for what's permissible, we've left a gap. If we do get a literal new earth, it doesn't change that we were gifted this one. We're expecting then to welcome Jesus back to creation in disarray after he's called it very good. Aside from all else, that's not the Scottish hospitality I've gotten to know. If we do get a new one, is it then business as usual? Will we do the same thing to it again? Are we expecting new earth on new earth on new earth? Or will it then be time to change? What is the catalyst we're waiting for? If we want God's kingdom to come on earth as it is in heaven, shouldn't that extend to our relationship with the earth? Pushing this off as a future problem that we don't need to worry about doesn't account for the human cost now. I'll be honest. Steeped in these stories, I'm steeped in them at work. They're on the news when I speak to my parents back home in California, where I wonder if they're going to be evacuated this time. It's hard to feel hopeful. It's a complex problem. It's going to take individual change. It's going to take recycling and turning lights off, but it's also going to take systemic change. It's maybe the biggest problem we've faced. But when I'm at my best, I do choose to hope. Not fluffy hope. I don't think a water bottle and a bumper sticker are going to fix it. Not a hope that lets me push it off and avoid it, but a hope that gives energy to muck in and get the job done. If I believe that God's overarching will and movement is to reconcile all things to God's self, and I do believe that, and if I believe that we're called into participation in that work, and I do believe that, then one expression of that for me is to take environmental stewardship seriously. So what now? That's a terrible, depressing note to end on. It is a big, complex issue. There's a lot of tension between what we can do individually, what we can do as a church, and what requires systemic change. And maybe the penny is still in the air for you on this, and that's okay. Maybe that means your next step is to read up more on it. If you would like book recommendations or podcast recommendations, you can speak to me. There's lots of individual actions. Helen touched on a lot of these already. Use your food waste bin. Carbon that is trapped in food and then goes into the normal landfill releases lots of gases every year that contribute to this problem. swap glass instead of plastic. If you're looking for upping your recycling game, plastic can only be recycled a finite number of times. Glass and metal are infinitely recyclable, so if you can have the choice between a plastic or a glass bottle, go for the glass. Think about your consumption, whether that's your lights or your energy use. Look into who your energy provider is and where they're sourced from. There's studies that suggest that even swapping out one or two vegan meals a week does make a difference, so you don't have to go whole vegan. I was going to say whole hog, but that doesn't work for a vegan context. You can do small changes, and they do still make a difference. One of the biggest changes you can make if you are eligible for a pension is to look at where your pension is invested. Many pension providers give ethical indexes as an option. And there have been stories of organizations, church organizations, that have gone together to shift their pension, and that has been enough to change the way that pensions fund, move from funding fossil fuels to funding more ethical options. As a church, Don's already told us, deacons are working really hard on this issue and how we respond as a congregation. We can support them in that. That's really important. Kitchen is transitioning from single-use plastic to other things. Bring your reusable cups. It's a way to show support. There's also an organization called Eco Congregations. They've got lots of resources for churches. And then when it gets to the bigger pieces, finding ways to join in advocacy. There are development organizations that are working on the front lines with this to help people adapt who are already facing these problems. As a church, we support Tear Fund. I work for Christian Aid. There's also the DEC, the Disaster and Emergency Commission. So that's these 14 organizations all work together. When there's like an emergency or a natural disaster, rather than getting 14 different appeals, they come together and put out one appeal and then work together to make sure that the money goes to people who need it the most. You can sign up to their email list and they'll only contact you when there is an immediate need. There are also people doing work in the energy sector. You can't avoid that in Scotland. We are invested in oil, and there are people who are working to make sure that those people are not left behind as we transition away into more natural or into more sustainable energy sources. Making sure that people are not left on the other side of an injustice as they lose or their jobs change. I said a minute ago, it's the biggest challenge we faced. It's also an opportunity. The church, global, has a unique offering of hope. So I'd like to close with this excerpt from a Christian Aid theology paper. In a world where many think that change will not come, Christian theology speaks boldly of salvation and redemption. In a world where hope is little talked about, faith can bear witness to the blossoming of hope, even in the profoundest despair. The central message of the Christian faith is, after all, of resurrection from death. It believes that even in the worst we can imagine, even if the worst that we can imagine happens, God can yet bring life. It has confidence in the sovereignty of God the Creator, who has promised always to be with us. This does not mean that we need not worry anymore about what the prophets are saying. On the contrary, it means that it is worth listening to them and worth giving our lives to the actions to which they point us. An imagination shaped by the Christian understanding of God's ways within the world can never say, we are all doomed. But neither can it say, let's eat and drink and be merry. Our hope then is like the hope of Amos, who both called the people to repent and who also told them that God says, I will restore the fortunes of my people. It's this kind of prophetic imagination and hope that we need in a time like ours. Thank you.